Okay, so I'm going to start this morning with a short reading from the White Lotus Sutra. Suppose there was a stretch of steep, bad road in a remote wasteland with many harmful beasts, a place, moreover, without water or grass, one dreaded by people. And a group of thousands and 10,000s wanted to pass over this steep road. But the road was long and far stretching. At this time there was a leader, well informed, possessing wisdom, of clear understanding and a determined mind, capable of saving endangered persons from manifold difficulties. And the members of the group were all weary and disheartened and said to their leader, "We are exhausted with fatigue and wish at this point to turn round and go back." And the leader thought to himself, "These people are truly pitiful. Why do they wish to turn back and miss the many rare treasures ahead?" So at this time he came, thought of an expedient means. Deciding to exercise his transcendental powers, he conjured up a great walled city and adorned its mansions, surrounding them with gardens and groves, channels of flowing water, ponds and lakes and double gates and tall towers and pavilions. And as soon as he had created this illusion, he comforted the group, saying, "Have no fear, you can enter this city," and each amuse themselves as they please. And when the people had entered the city, they were overjoyed in heart, with a feeling of ease and tranquility, telling themselves that they'd been saved. And when the leader knew that they were rested, he called them together and announced, "Now you must push forward. This is nothing more than a phantom city. I saw that you were weary and exhausted and wanted to turn back in mid-journey. Therefore, I used the power of expedient means to conjure up this city for the moment. And now you must press forward diligently so that together you may reach the place where the treasure is." So I chose this reading to open up this talk because it really lays at the heart of the reality of spiritual practice. It seems that to a lesser or a greater degree, we all go through a process of identifying with some method of development through which we're hoping to transform our lives. And yet, as we practice, we come to see that what we imagined as the outcome, the goal of practice, is not the same as what actually arises within and around us. It seems that the truth is that our life, it actually unfolds in its own way. It has its own pace, its own rhythm. And our thinking mind, our feeling body, seem to be always seeking out teachings, strategies and projects to try to keep up with and give form to and follow our unseen life. So in my experience, meaning only arises in the wake of lived experience. And this lived experience is arising out of a vast ocean of independent, interdependent conditioning factors. And we all live in deep rhythms of significance that we only ever know in retrospect. So as a small example, it'll only become clear by looking back over the events of this weekend of what this weekend means, why we came here, what drew us to be here this weekend. I suggest that we don't actually know that at this point. It will become clearer at some point. So, I also want to remind us through this reading that all teachings, all presentations of the Dharma are actually like phantom cities. They are, of course, useful support and to give us a sense of direction, but they are only ever just that. They only ever point us towards direct experience. The teaching themselves are not the goal. And it reminds me, reminds us hopefully, that our own Tri Ratna tradition is a restating, a reframing of something which is actually always beyond any particular form or view, any practice. And if we get too attached to a particular form or presentation of the Dharma, then it risks becoming a prison for us, rather than a doorway to freedom. So I'm not saying this morning in an attempt to undermine this very necessary process of using methods and conceptualizations to deepen practice. I realize that that is important. But as the reading suggests, without these imagined goals, without the support of method and the benefit of a community that is articulating practice in a particular form, we would probably become disheartened, confused, and probably drift away from the spiritual life. So we do need form. But the problem with any form is that it can tend towards literalism. So Buddhist ideas and practices are useful means as long as we don't grip them too tightly. So they are a spur and a support for practice. But as I've already said, the truth of our life and our community is that it's actually unfolding in its own way, with its own pace and rhythm. And our conscious conceptualizing mind is simply seeking out or creating meanings and teachings and strategies to try to keep up with and follow in the wake of actual lived experience. So all of us are living in an unfolding mystery of our personal practice and the community in which we're participating. So, I began talking this way this morning because the aim of my talk this morning is to attempt to de-literalise our relationship to spiritual practice and arising experience. So I'm talking this morning to encourage or support the dismantling of any gripping to any form. I'm talking in the hope that these few words will support the dismemberment of fantasies, the self-recreating bubble of delusion and fixed forms of being, knowing and living, which we all tend to inhabit quite naturally. And what I want to do through this talk is share my fascination and curiosity about what is arising and passing within and amongst us right now. Not in a general abstract terms, but as direct lived experience. And this is, after all, the path that the Buddha taught, the path that the Buddha exemplified. The solution for his attempts, his struggle to gain enlightenment, actually really bore fruition when he simply decided to sit with his actual experience, explore what was in his arising experience. So he'd given up, he tried and pushed with all the strategies that were on offer in his culture, but eventually he came to recognize that actually he simply had to sit under the tree and explore his experience. So this morning I'm emphasizing the nature of the spiritual journey as a real coming home to the actual, to the concrete. And tomorrow morning, Satchalila will be laying out some useful tools to help us explore and negotiate this territory, and to point to some of the potential fruits of this exploration of what I'm describing as the return journey. So I'm going to be looking at three areas to explore that might help us to see beyond the phantom, see beyond and maybe see through the phantom cities of literalism. So I'm going to be talking about the deliteralization of personal history and ideas, and then I'm going to say something about the deliteralization of time. And then this evening, through meditation, I'll be sharing an exploration of the deliteralization of space. So that's where we're going. So.
What was the first one again?
The first one is a sense of identity, really, personal, a view of self, personal history and ideas. So I'm going to be talking about this move from literalization, which I describe as these fixed, rather simplistic and mental structures which we place on and over and around experience. We shift from that to something alluded to by these few lines from Eliot. He writes at the end of the Four Quartets, We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of the earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. So these verses suggest to me that the spiritual journey is concerned with traversing the phantom cities of practices and ideas until eventually we simply let them all go and come home. And it's through this long epic journey that we come then to know this place, that which was the beginning, right here, as if for the first time. So this journey is a transition from the literal to the concrete, a shift from being bound by mental constructs to the liberation of entering and living out a clear, embodied, direct knowing. So what I'm actually talking about in this first section is I'm talking about releasing from the samskaras. This is a description of the mechanics through which we create a sense of self, which we then tend to literalize. So if you've been coming to Sangonite in Bristol, been referring to these quite a lot during the recent series on the Wheel of Life. And these are the conditioning factors created out of our interpretation of passing experience and the ideas that we have heard, seen, enacted, or read about. So this web of views establishes in us an ongoing sense of what or who we are. And it's very intimately connected to our sense of identity, status, personal power or authority, and the types of roles that we perform. And all this, these samskaras are the means that we've used to unconsciously adapt and adopt an identity, to make sense of and survive our family, the events of our life, and our wider culture. And this created ongoing identity of values and ideals and views help us to discriminate and filter this vast input of sensory data. And it also protects us from the inevitable sensations of either being completely overwhelmed or feeling abandoned and separate from life. So this filtering system of the samskaras is sometimes described as a series of veils which mask the open dimension of being, the natural state. Their primary biological aim is to help us survive, to help this organism to respond effectively to danger, to threat, to find nourishment and safety, But underneath these survival needs, there's a secondary role, and this is to construct and then constantly recreate and sustain an illusion of an ongoing me, the experience of an I. So one could say that the I is the ultimate ghostly city, the fabricated place of safety that we eventually have to set out from. The problem for the spiritual life is that we fail to recognise that these useful and relative constructs are no more than that. They are in various degrees useful or unhelpful. They liberate us or bind us, but actually, ultimately, they are all fabrications. So if we really question and become curious and interested in arising and passing experience, we discover that all sensations arise out of and are inextricably linked to an unbounded, utterly open, lucid and responsive reality. Much of our fabrications are attempts to hold us out of the disorientation, the anxiety, even terror of this open dimension of being, which initially appears to have no ground, no boundary, and no point of reference. So one way of picturing these samskaras is to see them like deep ruts or channels within the mind, which is carrying our interpretation of experience into particular well-worn directions. They create the often invisible construct within which we exist and through which we know this world. They hold ourselves out of the apparent chaos of knowing directly the implications of the truth that all conditioned things, the objects, the ideas, and apparent solidity of our world is riddled with the three marks of impermanence, insubstantiality, and ultimately unsatisfactoriness. So, I thought I'd better try and ground this in a bit of personal story to illustrate this conceptual framework that I've been laying out. So, when I was little, I shared a large double bed with my three sisters. And we lived in this broken down medieval timber house in the middle of Suffolk in the landscape. And we had no electricity, no running water, but it was a beautiful paradise. It seemed in my memory, we simply played all day in the meadow surrounding this ruin, and then we went back to this paradise, this kind of safety of the bed, of the four of us in this bed. And one morning, I think I was probably about 5 years old, I was lying next to my youngest sister, and with her face opposite mine. And I kissed her on the lips, and I told her that I loved her. And, in my memory, the very next night, I was in another room, in a single bed. I was sleeping alone, and listening to my sisters chatting and laughing in the big bed next door. So trying to make sense of this experience and wanting to avoid kind of getting myself into a place where I was going to re-experience that pain and aloneness created from very strong patterns of being in my life. So in a way, that small kiss really defined my life, or has defined my life in numerous ways. So it's created a patterning in my own mind, a core of samskaras that I've had to work with all my life. So the central veil, central samskara, that I have to protect myself and survive is that what I picked up out of that experience, what I created out of that experience, was a belief that it was the kiss that banished me. And out of this primary view, this primary samskara, I came to feel that if I express my real responses to really show who I really am, I risk being banished. I believed that love is dangerous, that who I am is ultimately unacceptable, that I will always be alone because I am a boy, a man. And as I grew up, these core samskaras became even more twisted and distorted that simple act of love. Because as I grew up, this well-hidden sense of rage and blame began to being put onto women. Because it was women's fault that was trapping me in the anxiety of feeling powerless to resist my feelings of attraction to them, whilst at the same time being tortured by the fear of getting something wrong and thereby being banished. So I felt bound by the fear of attraction and the fear of being ridiculed, shamed, banished for having those feelings. So this is the wonders of the samskaras. And around the perimeter of these quite kind of tight views, a whole other series of beliefs began to kind of unfold and develop. So I believed that because of who I am, ultimately I will always be alone. And I'll never fully understand how to play this game of human interaction. It seems that somewhere there's a secret that I haven't been let in on, that I don't kind of get what everybody else appears to know so well about relationships. So this is material that I have to work with, and but I thought I would just share that. And I'm sure, well, I know, we all have our own samskaras that we're working with, that will have coalesced out of small experiences. And this is the nature of the samskaras. And the unfortunate nature of them, the samskaras, is that when the conditions are ripe, these samskaras will be reenacted time and time again. They will come up into our consciousness, into our kind of into our bodies, into our emotional experience. So what we're actually working with a lot of the time, or I'm working with, I think we all do, is that we recognise these kind of movements of ancient patterns of being which kind of arise in our experience. And, well, we begin to choose to either just sit with them, be with them, turn towards them, or when we don't catch them, we simply reenact them. So I'm just going to read now another little section from the Lotus Sutra, slightly further along. We are like a poor and impoverished person who went to a house of a close friend, and the house was a very prosperous one, and they were served many trays of delicacies. And the friend took a priceless jewel, sewed it into the lining of the poor person's robe, gave it without a word, and went away. And the person, being asleep, knew nothing of it. And after they'd gotten up, they journeyed here and there to other countries, seeking food and clothing to keep themselves alive, and finding it very difficult to provide for their livelihood. They made do with what little they could get, and never hoped for anything finer, unaware that in the lining of their robe They had a priceless jewel. Later, the close friend who had given them the jewel happened to meet this poor person, and after rebuking them, showed them the jewel sewed into the robe. And when the poor person saw the jewel, their heart was filled with great joy, for they realized they were rich, possessed of wealth and goods. So I read that just because it seems to connect for me to this sense of the samskaras. That we've each created this cloak for ourselves, our samskaric cloak. So the world I experience, that I appear to meet, reflects this fabrication. And what I see in others, in their words and phrases, what I seek, what brings me solace, is all created by this cloak that I'm wearing, that I've put on to protect myself from the weather of the unknown. So I think for me, the spiritual journey is firstly to notice the fabric of our particular cloak. Unfortunately, this cloak is often invisible. We rarely see the way that the samskaras are rebuilding a partial reality by filtering and almost seeking out the experiences that will confirm our views. So these are really ancient ruts of mind, creating our perception of the world we travel through. And unfortunately, they're not going to disperse simply because we have an intellectual understanding of their presence. The cloak is firmly wrapped around us, woven around our being. So how can we release ourselves from this self-created ensnarement? Well, I'm hoping you're going to tell me. I'll give it a shot. So, this gift is offered to us, and this is bare awareness, which has been infused with metta, which is kind, which is interested and curious about our actual experience. With this kind, interested, curious awareness, we have an opportunity to create amongst the bare feelings and our responses to them the gap. We talked about this a lot. This gap between feeling and grasping. And we need to hold these two sides. So we have the bare feelings and we know the arising of the grasping, the samskara. And just holding those without acting out of them creates the gap. So sensing into the shift from this bare feeling to interpretation, we begin to see the warp and weft of our fabrications. But I can only do this by really seeing through the literalizing or the surface story and reaching down into the concrete experience. For me, it's particularly in the felt sense of the body. So in doing this, I can reconnect to an echo of the being who actually built these samskaras in the first place to survive. And for me, it's tasting that original being that is the jewel sewn into my cloak. So in looking behind, beneath the samskaras, what I'm actually seeking is the boy, the being, who it dared to express love. To the being that responds to the wonder, the mystery and beauty of being alive. So it's actually active imagination grounded in concrete sensations to reach back and down into this life which is carried by the seedling of my younger being. An attempt to welcome that energy home. And this feels like the long spiritual journey, the journey of welcoming home this young boy back into life. So again, just want to stress not to take this literally. I'm describing the effect of witnessing the fruiting of the narrative and not acting out of it. And what that leads to is an immediacy, an even rawness, which might describe as tender vulnerability. And within that feeling tone, there's also something that's really creative, responsive, inquisitive, and endlessly free-flowing. This is the energy that was alive in the young being who, for protection, had to construct the cloak. So by staying with and exploring feeling and the risings, shifting to interpretation and judgment, I can, on a good day, find my way back, feel my way into the physical and mental locks that seem to embody and give form to these personal samskaras. So it's something about finding the locks, the binds, that I can then begin to test and explore the edges, to sense into if there is more to the experience than I'm usually noticing. So this very much comes about listening and acknowledging what is actually arising. So it's not just in meditation. I'd say it's actually more likely that we feel the samskaras when we're in contact with others. We do feel them in meditation. We can know them as a kind of a way of holding, a way of being. But actually where they usually become most visible is actually when we are aware of our internal experience as and when we come into contact with other people. Peter Levine offers a really useful aid to this tender exploration, which some of you will hear, already know about. I've talked about it on the communication weekends. So this term, this tender exploration, is what he describes as pendulating. And I think this is a really useful methodology. So it allows me and anyone else to explore their bound energy without becoming either completely over-identified with the feelings held in the locks or being so remote from them that we can't really explore into them. So once we start to open, move towards this experience, try to really taste it, feel into it, what we might find, for me, around fear, anxiety, rage, loss, but also there's often a sense of a kind of suppressed exuberance, suppressed pleasure, which is sort of too much to bear. So through this process of pendulating, of moving towards the experience and then out of it again, I can feel into the felt experience and then when I need to, withdraw to safety for protection and relief from that experience. And then when I feel resourced enough, feel ready, can move gently back into that experience, can edge back into that territory, which is arising within the body, within the felt sense of the body. And this moderating of the strength of the reconnecting to concrete experience through this act of pendulating, I feel has been a great gift. I really feel very grateful to Peter Levine for having mapped that out. And the more I can do this, I reclaim the being who loved and loves, the responsive heart that wants to live and flourish through this body. And it's alive as a concrete experience, not of the past, but right here. So by testing the locks, allows the uniqueness of my being to come back to life. The patterning of my being begins to become more identified with the possibility of freedom simply rather than reenacting or reacting to the cloak, the constructs that the young being protected himself through. I'm aware it's quite a long talk. I'll just breathe a bit and give ourselves an opportunity to regroup ourselves. That's kind of... But I do want to say all I want to say, so I'm going to carry on. So I'm just going to read now a poem by David White, which is Start Close In, it's called. Start Close In. Don't take the second step or the third, but start with the first. Close in, the step that you don't want to take. Start with the ground that you know, the pale ground beneath your feet, your own way to begin a conversation. Start with your own question. Give up on other people's questions. Don't let them smother something simple. To hear another's voice, follow your own voice. And wait until that voice becomes an intimate, private ear that can really listen to another. So start right now. Take a small step that you can call your own. Don't follow someone else's heroics. Be humble and focused and start close in. Don't mistake the other for that which is your own. Start close in. Don't take the second step or the third, but start with the first thing. Close in. The step that you don't want to take. So these lines from David White echo for me this sense of stepping into the concrete, really coming home through and below the literalism of the samskaras. And for me, this is a crucial aspect of the path and the goal. And it opens into the second area that I'm just going to briefly talk about, which is about the movement towards attempting to de-literalise time. So the spiritual journey is a process of recognising that linear time is only a useful fabrication. But ultimately it's a phantom city and a restrictive view. The view of time as a linear progression is that it inevitably it places enlightenment in the future, outside of our current experience. It's somewhere over there, beyond this, right here. And yet the Buddha reminds us over and over that enlightenment is going to happen, does happen, is happening right here. And what I want to suggest is actually we move in and out of linear time without actually noticing. It's this truth that makes enlightenment here possible. And the easiest place that we discover that this is happening is when we shift from our doing mode to simply being. It's the difference between careering after the demands of our full diary to simply sitting on a bench drinking tea. So it's as if we drop into direct experience, as if we open out into a timeless realm. And actually what I want to suggest is that we dip in and out of time probably more than we notice. We are ongoingly offered endless gifts outside of time, yet because of our literalism, we can't connect them as anything distinct beyond or beneath this flow of linear time. So, as examples, I'm sure we've all had moments of finding real ease and stability in meditation, or simply becoming really engaged, fully present in a conversation or in some creative endeavour. Maybe as simple as just becoming really absorbed in a simple experience. Light on a leaf, light on water. It's as if these moments are timeless, outside of linear time. There's a sense of real precision to that experience, which seems to be the brightness and exactness of the experience seems to arise because it's not bound by a sense of progressive linear time. So how can we delitteralize time? I think the thing I've already mentioned is simply to make space for the concrete. So much of the pace of our experience means that we rely on literalism as a way of making shorthand out of the complexity and abundant richness of experiences that are arising and passing. And this shorthand keeps up the appearance of time at the expense of actual lived experience. And another way of giving value to time, another way of giving value to the timeless is to imaginatively bridge together those many experiences of timelessness. So it's as if by noticing the unity of those experiences that you begin to see the coherence and wholeness, which actually we're lifting out of when we get locked in literal linear time. So by making space to be rather than do, we facilitate access to the timeless. We establish a gateway to the utter simplicity, the abundance of the ordinary, concrete, embodied life, which is always available, ever present, beneath the flow of linear time. And one final thing to say is that if we look back on our life, we can see the way that significant experiences seem to ebb and flow in our life. Things become really crystal clear for us, and then we seem to get lost again in linear time. These things dip below the surface of our life. So it's as if we find ourselves dipping down into meaning, and then we resurface back into quite an ordinary sense of our life. So we have a linear experience and a deeper rhythm, which is more like the movement of a dolphin. So these deeper currents of emergent life seem to break the surface on occasions and then dip back down out of sight. So by beginning to release from the literal bind of time, we can begin to see and explore the deeper patternings of our life. We begin to recognise that which is seeking to become known, that has lived alongside and beneath our mundane literal life. So it is, I believe, that these are real deeper rhythms of life that we honour by meditating, by being rather than doing, and by following our heart's wishes rather than just doing the right thing. We honour the timeless by entering into service of our deepest values. It's these deeper rhythms outside of time that call us beyond the phantom city of fabrications, that allow us to be with our samskaras without reenacting them, and release us, or at least begin to point us towards our true home, our true being that has waited patiently for so long to be witnessed and lived, so that love can flow through us for the benefit of this suffering world. May it be so.